I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation about female suicide bombers. Are their numbers on the rise, and are they forced to do it? But first, a federal judge sentenced Louis Libby, former chief of staff to Vice President Cheney, to 2.5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Libby was convicted in March of obstruction, perjury, and lying to the FBI in the investigation into the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame. Libby becomes the highest-ranking government official to be convicted of a crime since the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s. Anna Marie Cox is Washington editor for Time magazine. She stepped out of the courtroom to give us a sense of what's happening there. Anna Marie, was this sentence expected? Was this the amount of time and the outcome that people expected?
You know, people really had no idea how this was going to go. It's a completely unusual case, obviously, and there was a reason to believe that he might get a light sentence of as little as a probation, not actually have to serve any jail time at all. He's a first-time offender. He has a long record of public service. There are many things that the defense argued that seemed quite plausible as far as, like, him getting a light sentence with no jail time.
Such as, what did the defense argue for in asking for leniency?
They leaned very heavily on the idea that he was a public servant for most of his life, that he could have gone into a private practice and earned a lot of money, but instead, you know, he served in the government and was played a vital role in the intelligence community. Now, I think that's sort of an interesting tack for them to take because it was his role in the intelligence community that Walton focused on in his sentencing, which is to say that he has an extra duty to the people in that community to, if he even thought he might be revealing the name of a covert agency, he, of all people, should have known how bad that would be.
This is Judge Walton. Well, we wonder, how far did the defense get? Did they get to make their appeal? And, you know, how did it play out this morning?
They did not get to make their appeal beyond, you know, asking for leniency in a sentence. In fact, it was sort of interesting that the government gave a fairly perfunctory presentation. They made their argument. They succeeded very early on in making the argument that Libby should be sentenced as though he was an accessory to the most severe underlying crime, which would mean the actual revealing the name of a secret agent. And Walton took that very seriously. And that's actually when you got the feeling that things might go badly for Scooter. And then you got the second feeling that things were going to go badly when the defense finished up its presentation asking for leniency and went to go back and sit down at the table, presumably to have a break of some sort while Walton would go back and figure out his sentence. And Walton called him back to the front of the courtroom and said, no, I already know. You know, I know what I'm going to say.
Yeah. Could you see Libby's reaction?
Yes, I could. It was a fairly blank reaction. He's had a good poker face the entire trial. I think that he grimaced just a little, but I think he was probably feeling himself inside for this. I mean, this, like I said, it wasn't completely unexpected by the end of the morning that it was going to go badly. Although if we all walked into the courtroom at 9:30 thinking he'd go either way, Walton was clearly very passionate about the idea that, you know, what the seriousness of this underlying crime, which is what I think he was paying attention to. And also, quite honestly, the prosecution made a very good argument to say we can't, you know, someone's position in life shouldn't make us more lenient.
We want to, again, underscore what you're saying by saying that Louis Libby was not charged with the leak of Valerie Plame's name, but with lying to reporters about his role in conversations about the leak. But first of all, is there a sense that he will appeal?
Oh, yes, definitely he will appeal. I think that I'm not a legal expert, but I have been observing the trial almost the entire time it's been going on. And I do have a sense that Walton, Judge Walton, you know, everyone was very aware that was going to happen if he was found guilty. And there was a lot of extra care taken, you know, so that when this trial is looked at by an appeals court, you know, they want to make sure that they dotted all the I's, you know, and crossed all the T's so that there's going to be no procedural reason to go back on this decision.
And we only have a few seconds left, Anna. Is there a sense that the Bush administration might pardon Louis Libby?
Well, there has been arguments from, you know, conservative stalwarts, among them Fred Thompson, you know, now candidate for president, that Libby should be pardoned. I think it would be very politically risky for him to do right now, Bush. Although then you could also say, what does he have to lose at the approval rating he is now? It's not like he could go that much further south.
And it is in the ether, as you say. Anna Marie Cox, Washington editor of Time magazine. Again, Louis Libby sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Anna Marie, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, guards at a police recruiting station in Baghdad gunned down a would-be suicide bomber today. A government spokesperson said a woman wearing a black abaya approached a group of recruits. When guards told her to stop and she didn't, they shot her and she blew up. Reports of female suicide bombers have increased in the last decade, and now Time magazine is reporting that the number may rise even more. Reporter Tim McGurk says there are signs of armed renegade cells within the militant group Hamas gearing up an assembly line of suicide bombers for a possible third intifada, and more women than ever are being recruited. Well, today we want to have a conversation about female suicide bombers. Why do they do it? Is their motivation different from men? Tim McGurk is bureau chief in Jerusalem for Time. His article is entitled Palestinian Moms Becoming Martyrs. He joins us from Jerusalem. Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Tim, a tough subject. We know that women as suicide bombers in Gaza and the West Bank is not new. It came about during the Second Intifada, 2003-2004. But what are you feeling that is new?
What's new is the fact that the major Palestinian militant group Hamas, in the past, had always been very reluctant to send out women as suicide bombers. And I think they thought that this was somehow wrong. They were conservative about it, and they felt that the woman's role is not on the battlefield, and it certainly isn't to blow herself up. But I think that as they become more desperate in Gaza especially, that they're suddenly looking at women and thinking, well, it's easier for women to penetrate through Israeli defenses. People in Israel expect nothing to come from a woman coming towards them at a checkpoint. And so they're taking advantage of this. And there seems to be a recruitment drive that we're seeing in Gaza and in parts of the West Bank.
And when you say Hamas may be more desperate, you write that it's desperate to be accepted as part of the Palestinian government by the rest of the world, but the rest of the world is not, because Hamas is still denying the right for Israel to exist. And it seems that in the past, the handful of suicide bombers that there were that were female were recruited by other groups, Islamic Jihad or Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. So this is, as you said, new for Hamas.
Yeah, and I think Hamas had been in a predicament because they went in strong with suicide bombings. They were the ones who sent more men out to sacrifice themselves. But then what happened is after the elections in March of last year, then Hamas, their leadership said, well, listen, we can't be considered legitimate if we're resorting to terrorist tactics like suicide bombing. So they declared what they call a Hudenauer, a truce, and they stopped sending suicide bombers into Israel until things broke down between them and the Israelis in Gaza and in the West Bank.
Well, you write about the first woman that was actively recruited by Hamas. Her name is Reem Riashi. She was a mother of two children who blew herself up at a crossing point in Gaza in 2004. What more do we know about her?
Well, it's interesting because since then, Robin, she's Reem Riashi has been held up as an example to other Palestinian women of the ultimate sacrifice. And in fact, they've even used videos that show a reenactment of her child finding a suicide vest in her mother's drawer and sort of trying it on, saying, well, the next generation is going to carry on the struggle. But the more that we looked into this particular case, the more we found out that this woman wasn't necessarily motivated by ideology, religion, or a quick trip to paradise, that she seemed to have been caught in an adulterous relationship, and she was offered two options. Either she faced the penalty for adultery, which is death, or she put herself up as a suicide bomber and go out as a martyr, and that's the path that she chose.
And bring honor to her family.
That's right. And to and to wipe away the stain of her adulterous relationship.
Right. By the way, her family denies that. You spoke to them. They don't accept any other version of the story other than the fact that she was a martyr. But I know you spoke to many Israeli intelligence people, but also Palestinian scholars who also indicated that they feel that, I don't know if specifically in this case, but that in many of the cases of these women, it is something like that. It's sort of being forced to make a terrible choice.
Yeah, this is something that that no Palestinian wanted to go on record as saying publicly, because they would get in real trouble with the militant organizations who want to close ranks and present the front that these women are doing it because of one reason and one reason alone, and that's that they're fighting against the Israeli occupation. But the more that we dug into the story, the more that we found out that there were sort of deeply personal motives for these women to take their own lives like this.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the videos. They're playing on YouTube, and we found one from Al-Aqsa TV. That's a channel of Hamas television. We're going to play it, and it will be interpreted by our Iraqi intern, Huda Ahmed, who speaks Arabic. And by the way, what you're seeing on the video is a young actor playing the daughter of the now-deceased suicide bomber, Reem Riashi.
Instead of me, you are carrying a bomb in your hands. Only now I knew what was more precious than us. Only now I knew why you sped up your steps. May your steps be blessed, and may our Prophet Muhammad Jerusalem be blessed. Me and Obaida wish we were there with you. Convey our greetings to our Prophet and tell him that Doha loves him. And her love will not be mere words. I'll be on my mother's steps after her.
Are any Palestinians protesting this, the sort of, you know, recruiting children?
I think that that it's not the sort of protest where they would go banging on the doors of the Hamas militants saying, listen, you leave our kids alone. But what they do do is they make it clear that they're to their kids, and they sit down with them, and they say, listen, we don't want you to follow this path. We want you to get an education. We want you to make something of your lives. But it's a very powerful magnetic pull that these young kids are hearing from the militants, from their classrooms, from the Hamas TV stations. And, you know, these are very young, very susceptible kids.
Yeah. You write that a profile of Palestinian women suicide bombers is emerging, and they're different from male suicide bombers. What, in what ways?
Well, you know, the men tend to be very young and very introverted and do it just for religion and for martyrdom and for the 72 virgins in paradise. And the women, by and large, tend to be older. They're better educated. Most of them have completed high school. Many of them have gone on to university. And so there's a lot more thought behind them and the reasons why they're doing it. But again, they do have ulterior motives.
Well, we're going to have more from Tim McGurk, Time Magazine, after a quick break. You're listening to Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now, and we're back with Time Magazine's Jerusalem Bureau Chief Tim McGurk about something he says is happening. He's seeing an increase in recruiting of Palestinian women as suicide bombers. Tim, before the break, you were talking about differences between men and women suicide bombers. The women, you report, tend to be older, better educated than the men. They also tend to have motives other than revenge and martyrdom driving them. You profile a woman named Wafa Samir Albis, who was burned in a kitchen fire in Gaza and had been receiving care on a regular basis from Israelis in hospitals in Israel. Then how did she get recruited?
One day, the militants went to her and they said, listen, look at you. You're disfigured. You're never going to get married. You're a burden on your family. The best thing you can do is to next time you go across the border, the Israelis aren't going to suspect anything. Take a suicide belt and blow yourself up and try to blow up as many of the Israelis as you can. And they put so much pressure on the girl and on her family that she eventually went across, and fortunately for her and for the Israelis, she was caught right at the checkpoint.
What did she say? Because she's in custody and she's someone who speaks. I mean, you know, was she apologetic?
You know, after the facade kind of broke down, and at the end, she, in tears, she said, "I've been used. I've been manipulated." Mm-hmm. And well, I think that's exactly what happened.
Well, but we want to rush to say that there are other women that you profile that didn't feel that way, that may have been more like the profile of a male suicide bomber. There's the 29-year-old lawyer Hanadi Jaradat, who blew herself up in a restaurant. And, you know, she was enacting revenge because her brother and fiancé, who were militants, had been killed in front of her.
I don't think you can rule out the fact that revenge is a very, very potent reason for these women to do it, just the way that it is for the men. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of these women have seen their families taken away, their younger brothers or husbands arrested. Some have been killed by Israelis. Bombs have fallen on their houses, on their schools. And I think it gets back, Robin, to that sense of desperation, to the sense that that there's nothing in their future, that it's all so bleak, that this seems to be the only way out and to make a difference.
And, you know, you write also that while these women are not promised 72 virgins, they are promised that they will become queens and they will become the fairest of the virgins that will await the jihad warriors. And that resonates with some women.
I think it does. And I think what's happening is that as the Palestinians become more and more disillusioned with their own leaders, with the so-called secular leaders that they have, and not seeing any gains, seeing all the promises broken that have been made, they're falling back on religion and they're falling back on Islam. And Islam and many other religions tell you that that the afterlife is more important than this life.
But I want to ask, because we know that Hamas, and many Palestinians have rejected, for instance, Al-Qaeda to a large extent, and that it's more of a nationalistic move, if you will, you know, movement. So what are we talking about here? I mean, what kind of numbers are we talking about? Because it makes an extraordinary headline when a woman does this, but is it still a small portion? I mean, what's the mood in the territories? Are most of people finding this appalling?
Well, I know that between 2002 and now, there have been 88 women who have tried to blow themselves up. Only 8 of them have succeeded. And if you look at just last year alone, Robin, there were 6 successful suicide bombings, and 2 of them were women. So I think it's becoming, sadly, it's becoming more and more accepted in the Palestinian territories that women are as lethal a tool in becoming a human-guided missile as the men are.
And yet you write at the end of your article that there are brief moments of humanity. One of them told to you by an Israeli security officer.
Well, I think that's right. I think, you know, it must be just a terrible moment when you're going to a place, you've got an explosive belt strapped on, and you're looking around you at the people that you're going to blast into oblivion along with yourself. And there was one case of a woman who managed to infiltrate inside Israel past all the checkpoints and was in a crowded marketplace and was just about to pull the button. And she looked around and she saw that an Israeli woman was pushing a baby in a carriage. And she looked at the face of the baby and she saw that baby so much resembled her own nephew that she just couldn't do it. She thought of killing that baby and what it would have been like if her own nephew was killed. And at the very last minute, this humanity took over, yeah.
And is it thought that maybe female potential suicide bombers may be more likely to make that last-second decision?
You know, I think I think it would be nice to think that women are more compassionate, but I think things have become so polarized here in Israel and then the Palestinian territories that women go into battle just like men.
Tim McGurk, Time Magazine bureau chief in Jerusalem. His article is entitled "Palestinian Moms Becoming Martyrs." Tim, thanks so much.
Okay, Robin, it's a pleasure.
And in other news from the Middle East, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas is saying that the violence among Palestinian factions is perhaps worse than living under Israeli military rule. Abbas made his remarks in a televised speech marking the 40th anniversary of the start of the Six-Day War, during which Israel captured the West Bank, Gaza, and parts of Jerusalem. The Palestinian prime minister called the 1967 war a black day for Palestinians, but he said Palestinians are now so divided they're on the verge of a civil war. Abbas's more moderate Fatah faction has been governing since March in an uneasy coalition with Hamas. Over the past month, dozens of Palestinians in Gaza have been killed in gun battles. Israeli troops and settlers pulled out of Gaza in 2005. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, Rupert Murdoch may have some competition for the Wall Street Journal if a billionaire investor teams up with the paper's employees. Also, our critic at large, Ed Siegel, on why he'd like to hear what's on the iPods of DJ Bob Dylan and Sopranos creator David Chase. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, Nature's iPod. After the news, Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. On his way to the G8 meetings in Germany today, President Bush spoke at a democracy conference organized by former dissidents in the Czech Republic. He directed some of his comments at Russian President Vladimir Putin.
In Russia, reforms that were once promised to empower citizens have been derailed, with troubling implications for democratic development.
President Putin has threatened that if the U.S. builds an anti-missile shield in Eastern Europe as planned, Russia could aim its own weapons at European sites. But earlier today in Prague, President Bush defended the missile shield plan, saying it's a protection against rogue states, not Russia. The Cold War is over. Tensions between the U.S. and Russia over the missile defense system threaten to overshadow the G8 meeting that begins at a resort in Germany tomorrow. German Chancellor Angela Merkel wants to keep the focus on tackling global warming, and she has proposed ambitious cuts to greenhouse gas emissions. And President Bush brings his own plan, his first plan, to combat climate change to the meetings. Lane Green is international correspondent for The Economist. He joins us with his perspective. Lane, first of all, this back and forth between the presidents, Bush and Putin, is it just, you know, words, or is there something more serious going on here?
I think there's definitely something serious going on. Russia is asserting itself in a way that it hasn't done since it was the Soviet Union. Putin's Russia is sort of bullying Eastern European former satellite states, and it's making it clear that it's not going to give the U.S. a free pass in the Security Council, the U.N., and so forth. So we have something closer to the Cold War than anything we've seen since the Soviet Union ended in 1991.
Former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski says they're laughing in the Kremlin, that Bush would think that inviting Putin to his father's home in Maine in a month is going to change this tense relationship. Another Russian expert said in the New York Times today that Putin's on a tear, that he may pick a fight at the G8. Is that your sense?
He might pick a fight, but I think that the thing to bear in mind is not that he wants to be confrontational, he wants to make enemies. What Putin has done, and one of the reasons he's so popular back in Russia, is he wants to restore a sense that Russia matters, that Russia is a big player on the world stage. And so if he can frustrate America, then that accomplishes that. But if he can also get Bush showing him a great deal of respect, inviting him to his home, then I'm not sure I agree with Brzezinski. It might be that he actually will take that as a sign that Russia is back, that Russia really is a worthy successor to the old superpower that was the Soviet Union.
Well, meanwhile, global warming is expected to be high on the agenda for the G8. Interestingly, Russia is out ahead on that issue because we read after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russian emissions also collapsed and reduced.
Russian industry collapsed. Essentially, all these clapped out old factories that were emitting and extremely polluting just stopped running. So Russia got a free pass because of this terrible old infrastructure that it had just ceased to be used. So ironically, if you look at the list of emitters, one of the worst behaved countries in the world is actually looking like one of the best countries on global warming.
Well, meanwhile, Germany's Chancellor Merkel wants G8 countries to pledge to cut their greenhouse gas emissions in half by the year 2050. Now, we understand that the Bush plan would call on countries with big economies to cut emissions. It would include countries like China and India, which will be in attendance at the G8, although they're not members. China and India were given a pass by the Kyoto Accords because they were seen to be emerging economies. The Bush people arguing, you know, that's just not fair and not smart thinking because companies will just move to countries like China and India and pollute. So how is Europe receiving Bush's plan to include China and India in emissions cuts?
Europe isn't opposed to the idea of bringing in China and India, but what they do want is for the process to be coordinated at the global level and through the UN or UN-related bodies, because they want it to be something like universal, even though China and India aren't part of Kyoto right now. But the Bush plan looks something more like, I hate to use this phrase, but it kind of is unavoidable, a coalition of the willing, the big countries that that Bush and the Bush administration sees as worth sitting down and talking to on this issue. But the Europeans are upset because it looks like it is a distraction from the Kyoto and the Kyoto successor process. And so those who aren't inclined to trust George Bush think that it is an intentional effort to derail the Kyoto and the Kyoto post-Kyoto process.
But on the other hand, it is the first time that the Bush administration has called for cutting emissions.
That's true, and I think it is a real concession. It is a real move. I mean, the politics of this have changed significantly. And when Bush said in his State of the Union a couple of years ago the words addicted to oil, that really was something. Now, the Europeans and the rest of the world are waiting to see rhetoric turn into substance. But I sense a real shift by the Bush people towards a seriousness on global warming. I don't think that it is a merely attempt to gum up the works with a rival to Kyoto plan.
In fact, The Economist writes that world leaders seem to be falling all over each other to see who can come up with a plan for cutting emissions and decreasing global warming.
Right, and to the extent that everyone is taking it seriously and you see a lot of leaders proposing plans, that's a good thing. But obviously, to make this work, everybody's got to get on the same page, and that's the point of the G8 summit. But that's the very difficult task that Angela Merkel has, because she's hosting all of these world leaders, all of whom are trying to claim some kind of credit for leadership in the process.
But aren't some countries saying that they're not sure they can meet Angela Merkel's demands that countries reduce emissions by 2050 enough to keep global warming at 2 degrees Celsius? They said they looked at it realistically. They're just not sure they can do it.
Right. Well, the Angela Merkel plan to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius is 50 years out, or by 2050, is something that's so, it's such a distant date, and economic forecasts work a lot like weather forecasts. They might be accurate for tomorrow, but they're very inaccurate 10 days out. And that's definitely true of any kind of economic and scientific forecast 40, 50 years out. So countries are clearly nervous, because when you talk about cutting CO2 and greenhouse gas emissions in half, that is a huge, that is a significant change in the way the whole economy is going to be structured. And so it's not surprising that some countries would say, look, we're just not sure this is possible.
And speaking of which, how much is really expected to come out of this meeting? There's already, you know, a chorus of critics of the last meeting, voices from Africa saying that there were promises to write off debt and end export subsidies. And those pledges haven't been delivered on from the last meeting.
Well, they haven't been fully delivered on. Some of them have, but some of the money is still in the pipeline. The leaders can get together and say, we pledge to double aid to Africa. But then, of course, as in every other country, George Bush has to come back to the U.S. and get Congress to approve this. It takes a long time. And so it's a really important role that civil society and these NGOs and people like Bob Geldof have to hold the feet to the fire and say, look, I don't want a new promise. Let's see you first fulfill the promise you made 2 years ago at Glen Eagles in Scotland.
Yeah. By the way, you know, we've talked about global warming and the relationship between Russia and the U.S. Is there anything else that you think might jump out ahead, maybe take people by surprise, that it, you know, takes up so time at the G8?
Well, I think that the biggest issue is going to be global warming. That's where most of the world's eyeballs are going to be, is do we get a significant commitment on that? And if there's only a sort of weak statement, it's going to be considered a failure. I don't expect that George Bush and Vladimir Putin will want to walk into the summit and have more verbal fireworks there together with each other, because that would really make everybody look bad. And so I hope that they will have gotten all of that out of their system before the summit actually begins.
They're going to be meeting privately on Thursday. Lane Green, international correspondent for The Economist magazine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And before we go today, did you know that there are 77 different kinds of crickets, katydids, and cicadas? And as you're going to hear, the cicadas sing the alto and bass in the insect choir. You're listening to Here and Now. Congress is hearing today about the nation's readiness for the 2007 wildfire season, and not a moment too soon. Wildfires have already engulfed southern Georgia, Catalina Island in California, northern Florida, southern New Jersey, and northern Minnesota, to name just a few high-profile blazes. Well, joining us to take a look at the season is Rose Davis. She's spokeswoman for the National Interagency Forest Center in Boise, Idaho. And Rose, we understand that when your colleague there at the center, fire analyst Tom Wardell, looked at this year's map, he said, "We're a bit nervous." Why? Why is that?
Well, I think that we are looking across the country at the drought conditions that have been in place for several years. We had a little snowpack in the west, and it melted fairly quickly. And we've had very little precipitation in California, which is not helping at all for most of the state.
Right. And last year, as we remember, was a terrible year, a record number of wildfires, burning nearly 10 million acres, costing about $1 billion, taking the lives of 24 firefighters. And we understand that six of the nine regions that you look at can expect the risk to be as high?
That's correct. And what that means is that the fuels, the trees, the grasses, the brush are very receptive because of their dryness to any sort of spark or ignition. And with that dryness over large swaths of land, you can get those large fires.
Now, what's going on here? I mean, and put this in context, because people might be saying, oh, yes, every year, you know, there's wildfires. Is this something that's really standing out for several years in the minds of people like yourselves who look at this in an overview?
I think what's really standing out for us is the continuing drought. It's a combination of the weather factors, climate, and the kind of fuels we have all over the country.
Well, and you know, as we've been hearing, climate change. We know global warming is on the agenda at the G8 meetings being held in Germany. And the recent report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change pointed specifically to areas that are in your hot zones, Arizona in the southwest, for instance, as having increased drought because of climate change. So, I mean, if it's been tough to handle with what we have, what are you guys thinking about what may be to come?
Well, I think what we can do is anticipate with our predictive services unit where some of our hot spots are now, our very receptive areas, and then what we try to do is predict where those sparks are going to come. For example, our predictive services unit can tell us we've got a lightning storm coming in. This area will probably have a little rain. This area won't. So what we do is preposition resources to do the best we can in anticipating where we're going to have fires.
We want to ask you as well, Congress, we know, is holding hearings today on the state of the nation's readiness to handle this year's wildfire season. We saw, for instance, recently after tornadoes, a lot of counties found that their equipment was deployed to Iraq. I know that's not your bailiwick, but do you think that federal, state, and county agencies are prepared for wildfires?
I think that we have about the same capability for responding to wildfires all across the levels, from the local and very important volunteers to the federal resources that we had last year. And I guess when you ask about readiness, it's very hard to give you a solid answer because we don't know what we're going to get.
Right. Well, last year, a record 2,300 buildings destroyed by wildfires. And we've noted that insurance companies are starting to use stricter safety standards before they'll issue new or renew existing homeowner insurance policies. They're getting tough. So what about homeowners? What can they do to reduce their risk?
Well, we are a big believer in homeowner responsibility because there's only a limited effort we can put into a very dangerous community is when there's things like propane and power lines and those sort of things. You know, we've had a site and a cooperator for a long time in FireWise, and FireWise.org is a great place for a homeowner or community to go in and say, if I'm at this slope, I need to clear my vegetation to this many feet. Here are some alternative building materials. Here's what I do if it's approaching me. Here's some ways to landscape more safely. And so we've been following this sort of thought process for years, and to have the assistance of the insurance companies to me seems to be a very positive thing.
FireWise. We'll let people know how to get to that at our website, here-now.org. Rose Davis, spokeswoman for the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Still to come, what's in that brush you're clearing? Crickets, katydids, cicadas, the songs of insects after a break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ah, the sounds of summer. Crickets chirping outside your window. But which cricket is it? Doesn't sound like the eastern striped cricket. No, it's more like the sphagnum ground cricket. Not to be confused with the confused ground cricket. A little confused yourself? Well, Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger can help. They've collected the songs of 77 crickets, katydids, and cicadas, along with gorgeous pictures and facts in a new book and CD set called The Songs of Insects. And co-author Will Hershberger joins us from the NPR studios in Washington with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What a huge effort here. Let's listen, for instance, to one of my favorites, just the name alone, the slightly musical conehead. What is this?
It's a conehead katydid, and it's usually associated with wetlands or habitats that have lots of moisture in them.
I'm not hearing the... What's the katydid sound in there?
Well, the slightly musical conehead is quite different from the common true katydid, which has the katydid song. The slightly musical, all the males in a particular area will synchronize their songs with one another. So it's just this really nice, soft, pulsating chorus of these wild-looking coneheads.
So the true katydids are the only ones who make that katydid sound. As we get ready to hear that, there's a story there. Tell us the story of how they got their name.
A young lady by the name of Katie had a suitor who ran off with another woman and got married. Soon after they got back from their honeymoon, the couple was found murdered sometime during the night. Mm-hmm. They were found dead. And there was really no evidence to link Katie to the crime, though everybody suspected it was Katie. It happened in late summer while the insects were active, and to this day, they tell the tale, Katie did, Katie did, Katie did.
As we're speaking of katydids, I'm looking at a picture of the protean shieldback katydid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I can see where the shield comes in. It looks like it's wearing one.
Right.
Tell us more about its sound.
Oh, the shieldbacks have a very raspy, dry, rattly sound almost, kind of a shushy timbre to their songs. They start singing at the end of day before the sun sets from the grass litter right on the ground. And as it gets dark, they climb up into the trees and brush and start singing at about eye level.
How do they make their noise?
The crickets and katydids produce their sound through a mechanism called stridulation. All of these insects have two pairs of wings. The front pair of wings are highly modified in the male to protect the true wings and to produce sound. So on the bottom side of one of those front wings is a little file of teeth. And on the top side of the other wing is a hardened ridge called a scraper. As he closes his wings, he rubs that scraper across those teeth and creates the sound. On the open stroke, he typically misses. He opens them up enough so it misses. So it's just on the closing stroke that he's making the sound. So that's stridulation.
And I understand that as we age, many of us are suffering perhaps from presbycusis.
Yes.
The decline of hearing. So we're not even hearing the insects that are out there, or a lot of them?
A lot of them. It's absolutely fascinating. When we were at Harvard giving a talk, the number of people that we would keep asking, can you hear this? Can you hear this? And a lot of people could not hear many of the insects. They're just too high-pitched.
Give us an example of an insect, a singing insect, that might be hard for us to hear.
Oh, definitely. The common virtuoso katydid is one that's extremely high-pitched. And the short-winged meadow katydid is the real test of someone's hearing.
Now, we're hearing that there because you've recorded it. But we might not hear it in the wild?
Well, a lot of people can't hear the recording as well.
Really?
Yes.
Also,
yeah, if you can hear that, you're doing really good. Protected your ears really well.
Well, I don't know when that happened, but so for those who couldn't hear, it was like a... Right?
Is that, yes,
is that
very
close?
Good. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I want to listen to the snowy tree cricket.
Yes.
I'm realizing now that some of our listeners aren't hearing anything we're talking about. But this is a singing insect that helps you tell the temperature to a house.
All the males in a particular area will sing in synchrony, so it makes it really easy to count the number of chirps in 13 seconds, and then you add 40 to that number. And it gives you a really close approximation of the temperature in degrees Fahrenheit.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to a warm male snowy tree cricket. Now a cold one. Oh, that is markedly different.
Yes, it is. All these insects are cold-blooded. As they cool down, so their entire system slows down. They sing slower, the pitch lowers a little bit, but their entire nervous system is keyed into this so that as they cool down, their auditory sensitivity also gears down so that they still recognize the same species, even though it's gotten really cold.
Hmm. Well, staying with, you know, temperature, cicadas, because we know the dog day cicada, that's the one that sings during the dog days of summer. But there's also the lyric cicada, the hieroglyphic cicada.
Uh-huh.
Where's that name come from?
The marvelous patterns that are on its back. If you look at that, it's kind of a turquoise background with these intricate black markings, which reminded the entomologist of hieroglyphics.
Hmm.
So that's how it got its name.
Let's listen to cicadas. I love that sound. There's something about it that signals summer and heat,
mm-hmm.
and great literature about summer and heat and all of that. what about you and co-author Lang Elliott? Now you've put this book together, all of these different sounds. Can you sit out on a summer night without, trying to catalog everything you're listening to?
It's very difficult because you start sitting there thinking, oh, there's a fast-calling tree cricket, or oh, there goes an oblong-winged katydid. You know, yeah, it's hard to just sit there and not identify what's going on.
And why is it important to know?
There are researchers at the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center outside of Washington, D.C., who are trying to start roadside surveys. The idea is to develop routes that are done every year. They would go through several different types of habitats. And from year to year, you count the number of singing insects that you hear. And then you develop trends over the years. You know, is this species declining? Is this species increasing? The other reason it's important is it gives you another aspect of appreciating nature. It is so much fun, just like going out and listening to birds and being able to say, oh, that's a northern cardinal or that's a northern parula. Now you can go out and you can say, oh, there's oblong-winged katydids, or, oh, there's a rattler round-winged katydid. You can now have this intimate knowledge of who's singing out there in the dark. Mm. You know, there's all this talk about nature deficit disorder in the young generation. What better way to get them interested in the out-of-doors than through bugs and bugs that sing?
Will Hirschberger, he and Lang Elliott have put together this really fabulous book and CD of photos, information, sounds of 77 types of crickets, katydids, and cicadas. It's called The Songs of Insects. Will, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Robin. It was my pleasure.
And speaking of cicadas, we have this note. A drama is unfolding in Chicago. Residents there are probably getting a little sick of hearing this sound, but it won't last long. The 17-year cicadas are back. For just a few weeks, they'll emerge from the ground. The males will make their unmistakable call. They'll mate, lay eggs, and die. And they won't be seen again in that area until 2024. A bug's life. Oh, and speaking of which, this is A Bug's Life Suite. For more information on The Songs of Insects, book and CD, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.